Well, hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Pretty sure if you're on the podcast with us, you love movies, you love music, and I'd love to introduce our next guest. Nitin Sawhney is a composer, wonderfully diverse in recording albums left and right. He's also played Royal Albert Hall, which is pretty cool. So, Nitin, how are you today? How's things in your world?
Things are very good. I'm just working on a new album. I'm also working on a new film for Disney at the moment, which is about tigers. And I'm also working on a TV series for Neil Gaiman right now, so which is for Amazon. So I'm pretty busy, but it's a really lovely sunny day and I'm in good mood. So yeah, great.
I love that phrase, lovely sunny day. My daughter, who's now 8 years old, she's watched Peppa Pig her whole life. So I always love, it was a lovely sunny day. But anyway, we're thrilled to be speaking with you. I have to say that What's Love Got to Do with It is nothing like what I expected. And I think there's an honesty to it. There's a sincerity. And at the bottom of this Trojan horse that is, you know, you could claim to be a romantic comedy, there's just a lot of universal messages, a lot of deep feelings, a lot of feels, so to speak. Before we get into that, what gave you the feels for music, and what keeps you going on a day-to-day basis?
Oh my God, my story with music goes back to childhood, to very early childhood. So I was a classical pianist from the age of about 4 or 5, and then I got into flamenco guitar. Then I was got into playing with orchestras, and I played a lot of jazz piano, having heard Bill Evans with Miles Davis. I fell in love with his playing. Then I got into film score, listening to film scores from Star Wars to John Williams and also Ennio Morricone, Bernard Herrmann, but also then got into a lot of Indian classical music. So and rock guitar. I was in rock guitar bands, all kinds of bands. So, you know, I grew up just with a very, very eclectic mix of music and influences from everywhere.
Yeah, it sounds like quite the musical salad bar. How did you deal with Morricone and flamenco? Are you a big fan of the Gypsy Kings by chance?
I mean, I like Gypsy Kings, but it was more people like Paco de Lucía or Paco Peña or you know, certain. I kind of loved some of the great flamenco players. I mean, Gypsy Kings are great, but they're more of a kind of pop side of flamenco, whereas. The side that I liked was quite deep. And, you know, I loved the way in which, because I was a full-on guitarist for a long time. I loved playing guitar. So the way in which you could get sounds out of the wood of the guitar, the way you would be able to do tremolo and kind of really, really explore what the guitar was capable of, you know, with an acoustic nylon strung guitar. I loved all of that. So, yeah, I mean, lots of different things. But, of course, the Gypsy Kings are great, you know.
Well, you bring up Paco. I know one song of his very well. I can't even try to play it that well. But it's another band that I found, funny enough, going to Sharper Image. Remember, they used to have some really interesting world music. It's a band called Lara y Reyes. And they had what sounded to me like some, I'm just going to say flamenco, but I'm completely wrong. But that's what's great. You know, there's accessibility and you're learning from all these different places. So how did the... Tell us more about the classical piano and how that maybe spearheaded some of your efforts into other instruments.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the piano is it's a fantastic, I mean, it's an orchestra and an instrument, as is the guitar. And one way, I mean, Andre Segovia actually said that an acoustic guitar was like an orchestra, but the piano for me is very easy to kind of understand. I mean, you can look at the patterns, you can look at the keyboard and understand it, you know, if you play it for a while. It opens up the way in which you look at harmony, in which you look at melody and how everything works together. You can play with it rhythmically. There are so many ways in which you can explore the possibility of piano. And I quite often, if I'm writing for big orchestras or anything like that, for films and so on, I'll start off with the piano in order to kind of create the feel that I want. And then I'll start allocating different or assigning different parts of what I played on the piano to different sections of the orchestra. So the thing for me is that the piano always felt like the root of everything, the source of everything. And you can even play Indian classical rags on a piano. You can play all kinds of different, you know, cultural influences you can put into the piano. So Yeah, I mean, I just always was a huge fan of that sound, and you know, I guess I loved listening to classical pianists, but also obviously, as I mentioned earlier, Bill Evans with Miles Davis, Oscar Peterson, Art Tatum, you know, Dave Brubeck, a lot of great pianists from different genres. You know, I was always really checking them out.
Well, when you use people like that as your inspiration or your North Star, did you ever get to, like, what was your Rocky moment? You know, you think of Rocky running up the stairs after, you know, weeks and weeks of training, and you're like, you did it. What was a cue, a symphony? What was something on the piano that once you nailed it, you're like, yes, I'm in, I got this.
Oh, I think it was playing Fantasy Impromptu by Chopin. Which is kind of a very, very tricky piece to play. So when I was 11 years old, I remember kind of playing it over and over again. And then because it involves a lot of really intricate work with your right hand and so on. So, yeah, that was tricky. Playing some of Beethoven's third movement of Moonlight Sonata was really tricky. And a lot of there's a particular Bach two-part invention that is quite hard to play. I think it's number 8. Which is actually in F major, I think. So yeah, I mean, with a lot of these pieces, they were technically quite challenging. So I remember when I got to the point where I could play them, I was really happy. And then I think, you know, playing a lot of classical music, you know, really made me listen a lot more, or helped me listen a lot more carefully to orchestras and what orchestras could do. So when I'd hear people like Bernard Herrmann with his work for the Hitchcock films, or John Williams. And John Williams was actually, again, he started off as a great pianist. I mean, he, in fact, used to play piano for Mancini. In fact, I think he's playing piano on Moon River in Breakfast at Tiffany's. And, you know, so he started off with the piano and kind of moved on to composition with film and orchestra. And I think, you know, that for me was very much the route that I kind of ended up taking as well. You know, I love the piano first, and then got into working a lot more with orchestra over time.
Well, what is the biggest difficulty or hurdle transitioning from one instrument, even though you said you can hear the symphony on it, to actually working with the brass, the woodwinds? How do things correlate, and how do you bridge that gap?
Well, really, it's they correlate. I mean, obviously, harmony is you know, something you can allocate. I mean, you know, the language of music is a universal one, so you can write down in the same way that you write down everything for a piano, for piano parts, you can write down for each of the instruments, and so, you know, whatever you've written onto the piano, you can then be transferred onto individual instruments, and then you kind of have to balance the sound, so you kind of expand it out. It's kind of like expanding out what you're doing and blowing it up into something where you're allocating to different sections and so on. And then, you know, you start to hear how, in a way, what you did on the piano originally is replicated in the size and sonic of the orchestra. So I guess it's kind of it's an expansion idea, really. You know, taking each part of the harmony, each melody line, each section, and expanding upon it orchestrally. But also, I guess, you know, from my point of view, I work in multiple ways. Like, you know, I'll work in StaffPad, which is a program where there's handwriting recognition, so you can write directly onto the staff, onto the stave, and then onto the conductor score. But then, in addition, I'll work simultaneously with Logic Audio, with Logic, and which is a digital audio workstation where I'll program up or I'll mock up various sounds using plugins from software manufacturers like Spitfire Audio. I'll use some of their plugins, and I'll kind of use the string sections from them, or I'll use brass and so on. So it allows me to kind of simulate very well the kind of sound that I'm going to get from the orchestra. And when I was working, for example, on Mowgli with Andy Serkis, you know, I remember him being very, very surprised by how close the orchestra sounded to what I'd already created through programming. And, it, you know, it's very interesting when you see directors who who kind of like see you working on a keyboard and then see an orchestra playing it, and it becomes something living and breathing in a very different kind of way.
Well, I mean, Andy is somebody who's different, who's tried his hand across multiple parts of the film industry, from acting to directing to, you know, pioneering a lot of the primate motion capture. But I'd like to draw a parallel to that, to what you were saying before. You're working on a show for Neil Gaiman, you're working on something for Disney. Where in the process did you I guess learn time management and the difficulty in or the pacing yourself to juggle more than one thing at a time?
Well, I'd be arrogant to suggest that I manage that very well on my own. I think I definitely have a lot of help. So I have a very competent and brilliant PA who's worked with me for 17 years, whose name is Tina. But then I also have Harry Simpson, who works for me as an engineer. He's worked with me for the last 7 years. When I'm touring with my band, I have a really strong team of people. If I'm working with orchestras, I sometimes will conduct, and sometimes I'll work with conductors and I'll play the piano. But I love collaboration, and even my new album, Identity, is very much, which is going to be out later this year, that's very much about collaboration with different artists and kind of finding common ground, but also finding a collective voice where you feel that you have something to say together to the world. And I think that's very exciting when you work with other people in that way. And I guess I'm always trying to do that, whether it's just literally, you know, kind of with the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis, or whether I'm working with directors or producers. And I think time management, you know, for me is very much about what you enjoy and what you love doing. So when you love what you're doing, you always find the time, I think. And if you have people to help you do that, then it's a lot better. I mean, I'm an insomniac anyway, so I'm kind of like able to juggle quite a few projects simultaneously. And also, you know, what I try to do is create possibilities. So for example, when I'm on tour, I'll take a laptop with me and a keyboard. And if I'm in the tour bus, I'll sometimes be writing music for specific scenes or cues or other things like that, where I just might be drafting it, and then I'll get back in the big studio and finish it off. So yeah, I'm always working in different ways.
Well, I'm glad you're able to take that conviction and actually deliver on it, because usually when I travel, I'll put a pair of shoes in a suitcase and think I'm going to work out when I get to the hotel or whatever, and it never happens.
No, yeah, I know. I've been there too many times. Yeah. But I mean, I think when you kind of like get into routines, and when you kind of like also really enjoy a project, then like I said, I think the thing is never to feel that what you're doing is work, or think of it as something where it's a mountain to climb. It's always about enjoying the moment and finding what you can in what you're doing at the time. And I really do believe in that. And I think that really helps you to optimize your time and to get the most out of the time you have.
Well, going back to what you you mentioned, being on tour and live music is something that, you know, ever since we got out of the pandemic, people have just been loving. Can you tell us what the first show you saw as a youngster, and maybe what the first thing you saw once the ban was lifted?
Wow, I'm trying to think now. My God. So the first thing probably I saw as a youngster in terms of a show, I think it might have been Santana, Carlos Santana, because my brothers were really into him and his band. And I think I went to see him at Wembley Stadium or whatever, long time ago. So I think I saw him performing, and I was a huge fan because I was already a guitarist. So I was probably around 7 or 8 at that time. And then I guess after the COVID ban, well, it was the first thing that we did was our own show, So that was quite mad, and that was at the Royal Albert Hall. I mean, I've played there many times in the past, and I've actually played Hollywood Bowl and also played at Sydney Opera House and quite a few amazing venues around the world. But I always love playing the Royal Albert Hall because there's a real sense of occasion there. It feels very, very special. And so coming back there during that time to a great, great crowd who were very, very, very appreciative of the fact that we were back, that was amazing. In terms of going to see anything, I mean, I think I saw, what did I see during that time? Trying to think. There's more stuff like, I think I saw an orchestral performance from the Chinookay Orchestra. But yeah, I don't think I saw much for a while, even after our show.
All right, fair enough. Well, let's move on to What's Love Got to Do with It? It's a very touching film. Your music takes what's already there and elevates it. The piano work is phenomenal, even the very simple twinkling of the piano keys. But can you break that down, how you built a palette for a I'm an American cinema goer. There's some things in since it's set in London went over my head. How do you cross the cultures with your music?
Well, I mean, I guess I try not. I don't think about doing it. I kind of more. It's more about serving the emotion and the feeling and what's going on in the specific scene, and then building, like you said, building a vocabulary, of sounds and flavors that is going to complement everything. I guess that palette that you were speaking of, I mean, the way in which I worked with the piano and so on, I was using influences from Indian classical rags, and rags are kind of like scales in some ways, but they're more intricate in that they reflect the time of day, the seasons. Rag literally means color in Hindi. And it's about different moods and colors. And so those different scales and modes are reflective of different feelings. So in a way, it's a ready-made vocabulary for cinema composers, for film composers. So I guess that was something I kind of drew on. I mean, there's a particular rag called rag desh, which is a certain type of scale which worked very well, and it enabled me to transcend those barriers between the Asian influences and the Western classical influences and so on. So I was jumping around quite a bit. The thing was also to be judicious in how much music I wanted to put in there, because I also think that there were some great performances in this film, and I didn't want to smother them with opinionated music. I wanted to make sure that the music just kind of would reflect their work and be guided by the performances more than anything, and the narrative and the psychology and the brilliant direction of Shekhar Kapoor, as well as Jemima Khan's great script.
Well, that's, I'm really glad you brought that up. There's two, I would just call them opposites. I think there's a part where Qasim is having dinner with his family, and you would maybe think that it would have some sort of very subtle underscore, but there was nothing. And then somebody mm-hmm. might also think that there's a, whenever Emma Thompson's on the scene, it's free reign to do Looney Tunes stuff. Like, but then there's not. But then there's really beautiful moments, like when Qasim first meets Mamouna, there's this beautiful golden light just casting. And then you've got this wind instrument that really heightens the scene. So I think I take what you're meaning, where you pick up on certain scenes and the meanings behind it. So.
Yeah, I was looking for more the emotional colours and so on. And I think, the particular wind instrument you're talking about is known as the bansuri, which is an Indian classical instrument which is played on a bamboo flute. And the versatility of Ashwin Srinivasan, who also plays with A.R. Rahman, is a great musician. A.R. Rahman, the great Oscar-winning composer as well. I think Ashwin's got a great way of bringing through the emotion of specific moments. So I love working with him. He's also in my band, and I've known him a very long time. But I think, his flavors actually really worked well with this film and the different moments. strings as well. Towards the end of the film, I kind of took a different, you know, I took a few different turns during the course of the film because the film itself did that. So I needed to kind of be able to move with the film and what the film was doing. So I guess I just tried to do that as much as possible.
Well, can you, I don't want to jump to the end, but the end of the movie, there's an emotional reunion that happens and it is phenomenal. I mean, I think there's so much weight to it, but then what your music brought to it just was like, I feel my face has been beaten up by the emotional punches that your score is hitting me with.
But well, that's good.
But then there's a part earlier in the movie where Kasim and Zoe are on a rooftop. Some music plays in, and then it's kind of quiet for their talk. And then after they leave, they're texting each other, and then the music kind of plays in. It's really a lot of string work.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So can you talk about coming into a scene and then letting the scene breathe and maybe like transitioning scenes with music?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do... Yeah, I also, you know, worked a long time in theatre. And I think, you know, that was where I think I learnt about the value of transitions between scenes. It kind of helps to create a greater sense of continuity and connection between scenes. It kind of also helps us to stay engaged emotionally when, you know, when we're moving from one moment to the next, one scene to the next, you know, one location to the next. And so I do believe that it's about holding people's attention with something that kind of feels like it can work for both moments. And that actually means that you have a more seamless way of viewing a film, you know. And I think for me that's very important. And I do believe also when you have great actors, I mean, you know, obviously Lily James and Shahad Latif were amazing in this film, and you know, as was Emma Thompson and so on. Everyone really gave great performances, and I wanted to compliment those. You know, Asim Chowdhury was comic turn as well, you know. It was great seeing how much they were able to bring to the table without help. And so, you know, I don't like underscoring things where you cannot quite often smother the performance with music that feels didactic, you know, kind of manipulative of the audience. So I kind of think it's more important to let, as you rightly said, to let the performances breathe, and for the actors to really, you know, because I enjoy the craft. I enjoy watching the craft of acting and people really drawing you into their worlds. And so if it's needed, then of course I'm there with music. But if it's not, then, you know, it's important to be able to know when to hold back.
The thing that I took most from this movie is how it turned things that you're used to hearing or social expectations, and it really opened it up, and it was honest, even turned things on its head. Like there's quite a few scenes where Lily James is talking to her nieces about fairy tales and kind of breaking them apart. Just made me, you know, change a paradigm shift, if you will. Are there experiences in your career listening to music, playing music, being around other musicians that you know, you learn something like, wow, I don't know why I never thought to do this, or how, you know, this changed my perception. Anything that sticks with you like that?
Yeah, quite a few times. I mean, you know, I mean, I've been lucky to work with some incredible musicians. I mean, working with Paul McCartney was incredible. Many years ago, he actually recorded one of my albums, and seeing how he worked was a privilege to watch close up, you know, to write a track with someone like him is quite unbelievable. Or, you know, even very early on, I watched Ed Sheeran. You know, I knew him when he was first starting out at Access to Music. You know, I was a patron of that. And I remember seeing him and thinking it was interesting watching him work with, you know, just loops and a laptop or you know, it's you always learn from people that you kind of meet or watch or work with. And sometimes you'll work with people who are very, I mean, yeah, there's all the time there are people that I work with who have their own way, their own system of doing things, and it always informs you, it always teaches you how to think in a different way. Working with great programmers over the years in terms of how they use digital audio workstations, that's been great. Some of the people from Spitfire Audio, I've been lucky to meet and see how they work. So yeah, I mean, I guess I try to learn from people, but obviously instrumentalists, you know, I'm a big fan of great players, but I'm also a big fan of great players who know when not to play, you know, overplay or show off. And, you know, it's interesting when you'll see players who are desperate to prove how great they are as musicians, but they forget that they're fitting into a composition which is telling a story. And so it's you know, for me, I'm always looking for musicians who are not only virtuosos, but also very empathic and have a real understanding of narrative and can work with you to bring out the best in what you're doing.
Well, you certainly brought out the best in this score in this movie. When it comes to, you know, I talked to Henry Jackman a number of years ago, and he gave me this great expression. He said, you know, when I work, it's fast. And I would love the opportunity to say, to beard stroke, just be like, let's think about this some more. So when you're under the gun, whether you have three projects or something, do you get the time to take, you know, six, seven passes at something to make it great? Or do you just unfortunately have to hit it right out of the park every single time you start?
No, it's quite nice in that a lot of the projects I work on, quite often I have time to really make sure that I find the right sounds and flavors. And I'll work very closely with directors. I love working with directors who are, you know, I think directors, good directors, are such an intelligent breed of people. And they, you know, they really understand human nature like no one else, and really can find story and drama in almost everything you look at, you know. And this is the thing, is that the imagination of the people that I've worked with, like Andy Serkis, or in recent years with Claire McCarthy, or Mira Nair with Namesake, and, you know, I mean, it's amazing to me how much vision these people have. So you're able to just bounce off them and just kind of, it feels very effortless to work with people like that, because they're very inspiring. It's just as simple as that.
Well, I'm inspired by the band Suri. I have to go back to that. One of my favorite scores in the last 10 years has been Jeff Danna's score to Life of Pi, Ang Lee's.
You mean Michael Danna?
Michael Danna, sorry.
Yeah.
Which had similar vocal, had a commonality of vocals in Ben Suri. And I just, whenever I hear it, it's just so enchanting. I love going to symphonies because I'm here in Dallas. I've done some work with the Dallas Symphony. But whenever I go, they play something, whether you listen to Bach or Ravel or even Williams, you know, your ear, not being a musician, picks up something. And then when you see it on stage, you go, wow, that's how they did that? And so I would just like to be, you know, I would like to learn more about the bansuri and these other instruments. So,
well, yeah, I mean, like the bansuri is just an incredible, it's got a beautiful sound. And it's interesting. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Michael Danna. He's one of the few people, to be honest with you, from the Western kind of film composer side, who I think really knows how to approach the use of Indian classical music and how it integrates with Western sounds. I mean, there's not many people who do it well, to be honest. People who do try quite often end up with something that feels contrived, and it doesn't really have the grace that you need. I think you need to have a feel or understanding of the rag system. You have to have, you know, been brought up listening to Indian classical music. And I can tell, I mean, from Michael Danna, unless I'm completely mistaken, that he definitely has a feel for Indian classical music and understanding of it. So I think that's great. But I think also it's a very expressive instrument. Like Ashwin Srinivasan is also a great vocalist. So he's somebody who really brings a vocal kind of sensitivity to the way in which he plays the bansuri. So it really feels like an extension of his own voice.
Well, you seem like you love your job. You wouldn't be doing all of this work if it wasn't just bringing you joy. Like you said, you got to find something you love. How do you have fun in your day? How do you interject little moments of levity? And do you ever put little Easter eggs in your scores? And the reason I'm asking this is because there's a funny, this is how my mind works. I'm watching Lily James talk to her nieces. She's talking about princesses. She brings up Cinderella. She played Cinderella. Patrick Doyle did the music. I was thinking in my mind, in Hitchcock, Hitchcock would probably be like, why don't you take a riff on Patrick Doyle's, you know, music for Cinderella, just for a laugh. But I'll stop rambling. Do you ever have, you know, what kind of Easter eggs and fun do you have when you're scoring?
Well, I mean, it's always fun. I always enjoy it. Yeah, because every mood that you're scoring is still fun for the composer. So even if you're scoring something that's quite dark and depressing, it's still a lot of fun to write, you know, which sounds kind of like a paradox, but it's not. You know, I mean, when I'm at the moment, you know, like I mentioned, I'm writing the music for this Disney documentary about tigers, and it's absolutely stunning, and I've really enjoyed doing that. You know, we're kind of in the middle of it at the moment, but it's been great, because the thing about it is that there are lots of fun moments. I mean, these, you know, when you work, I mean, I've worked a lot with natural history, and I love, you know, I did the Human Planet series, I did another series called Wonders of the Monsoon, you know, I really like working with animals, with nature, where I think there is a lot of humor in nature. I mean, you know, when you're looking at these tiger cubs kind of like, you know, just kind of like learning to kind of clamber and hunt and kind of, yeah, but they're tiny. And that you think of these things as, you know, these creatures as being, you know, very cute and sweet. And then, you know, literally a year or two later, they'll see you as, you know, dinner. So it's kind of like, you know, so I kind of think it's an amazing thing. So actually to kind of create these little kind of moments of fun within a film like that, where you are looking at a really strong, you know, like top of the tree kind of predator, you know, and you're kind of, but you're also finding moments of cuteness and sweetness and so on. I like doing that. I think that's great fun. In terms of references, I guess, is one of the things you mean as well when you talk about Easter eggs, references to other films, references to, that's something I did when I scored Hitchcock's silent movie, The Lodger. And, you know, at the beginning of it, because I did it with the London Symphony Orchestra, and at the beginning of it, I kind of put in some references to Psycho and so on. So it's kind of like, I really enjoy that, because I love Bernard Herrmann's work, as I've said several times already. But I think, you know, for me, because I was scoring a film that Hitchcock had done from 1927, it was a real opportunity to kind of like make some, you know, some tongue-in-cheek kind of references to my knowledge of Bernard Herrmann as well.
That's amazing. You know, I remember, and I bring up Patrick Doyle again, because he scored pretty much everything Kenneth Branagh has done, but he did Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit. But there's this part where Chris Pine walks into a hotel room that's been put back together after a brawl, and on the radio is actually playing the theme, like the Jack Ryan theme. And I had to ask him about that. He goes, yeah, that was like kind of a Hitchcock moment, just this little twinkling. Anyway, have a question for you. There's a line in the movie. Let's get deep. Let's get psychological. There's a part in the movie where you know, Kasim is basically realizing that even though he entered into this arranged or assisted relationship, this marriage, he's doing things for you know, basically everybody else but him. So I guess when it comes to music, do you feel like you're doing things for yourself, or do you feel like you're doing things for other people?
What's the difference? Yeah, I mean, it's different circumstances. I mean, when you're writing, I mean, I'm lucky in that I have another very strong career as an album artist. You know, I'm signed to Warner Music. I've been making albums for 30 odd years, you know, so, and I've worked with a lot of different people. Last year I was playing in Pink Floyd's band, you know, and as a member, you know, playing keys. And it's been great, because I get to work with people I've admired all my life, and you know, and make my own albums and do things that I want to do. But at the same time, when I'm working, you know, on a film score or a TV score, it's very much about serving the vision. I like doing both things. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, if you're a DJ, you're playing music you love, but you're also serving the audience, because you want to see people dancing on the dance floor. You know, it's the same thing. You're constantly kind of navigating that in between world of communicating and being cathartic, you know, as an artist. So you're expressing what you feel, but at the same time, you're aware that you're communicating to audiences. So you're always thinking ahead and trying to see your work from other people's eyes as well.
Well, I'm going to draw a parallel here, which is going to take us into the fun part of the interview. Seeing people's work through other people's eyes. Please tell us, what is the artwork, the beautifully stunning mountain scene behind you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. Oh, well, that's actually Andy Serkis took that photograph. So he took it, and I bought it for a charity. So it was kind of like her Best Beginnings, which is a charity that we both support. And it's actually Andy went up to he went to base camp on Everest. I mean, he's a climber, as you could probably tell. He's extremely agile when you think about him playing Gollum, because the motion capture was all him, you know, running around as well as the voice. He took that picture there, and it's a lovely picture. So yeah, I fell in love with it and thought, yeah, I've got to buy that. So there you go. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, amazing! You know, I saw the woman with the bubbles, the cat, and the martini glass.
It's not actually a woman. The woman with the bubbles is me. I suppose you can't really tell that. So yeah, from here, but yeah, it's like I'm quite pretty. So there you go.
Very, very humble, Nitin. Very, very humble. Okay. You know, I was speaking to some of your contemporaries about music. I talked to John Powell. I've talked to, have not talked to David Arnold, but I was, funny enough, I was listening to David Arnold's Hot Fuzz, the Edgar Wright movie. And on the bottom of the liner notes, he says, listen to this music in the greatest music medium of all time, vinyl. John Powell, on the other hand, says anybody who listens to vinyl are idiots. So where do you fall? I might be paraphrasing Mr. Powell, but where do you fall? Okay. Okay.
So, I mean, I love vinyl. Vinyl's amazing to me. I think vinyl's incredible. Vinyl was what I grew up with. So, I mean, like my next album's coming out on vinyl. Every time I put out an album, I always put it out on vinyl. Vinyl's got soul, and it's got its own sound, and it's warm and it's beautiful. So, yeah, I mean, like, I swear by vinyl. It's fantastic.
Okay, you know, I'm going to have to go back to that podcast I did with him. I think what he was talking about was there's certain warmth that people think is there that's not, and it was this whole scientific explanation.
Well, the science actually says the opposite, you know, but I won't go into that in too much detail. But I mean, you know, I've sat and had long conversations with manufacturers of not only vinyl records, but also of record players, and it's incredible. It's craftsmanship, and you know, it's and also, to be honest with you, I do think there is something wonderful about, you know, about the idea of the mechanics of just literally picking up an arm and putting it in, dropping the needle on the record. There is something that is, there's an act, and for me, it's a ritual. You know, there's a ritual that helps you to engage with the music. And I think, you know, when you have, there's also this idea that music, if you think of it in a digital way, the idea is that it has immortality. You can constantly share WAVs or MP3s with people. They never go away. They're always there on the internet. Whereas a vinyl, one piece of vinyl, it'll wear down. It has a life. You know, there's something poetic and beautiful about the lifespan of a record compared to an MP3 or WAV. And obviously you've got this stunning artwork, you know. I mean, that's the thing, you know, like, I mean, you know, I'm still talking. But yeah, I mean, like this is a beautiful cover. I mean, look at it, and it's got information, you know, you learn about what's going on with this record, you know. So I used to love reading through the sleeve notes. What we're talking about is a tactile experience compared to a kind of cold-hearted kind of, or a cold clinical way of listening to music that is just kind of brought to you through bits and bytes. You know, I'm thinking of music that is kind of that is captured with love and craft and craftsmanship, and there is a warmth in the experience as well as the sound.
Nitin, why don't we round this out with one final question? If you could go back in time and give a younger self three albums, and they could be yours, and maybe like give them a heads up on, you know, film scoring or something like that. But what three albums do you wish your younger self could receive?
Huh, wow. Probably Protection from Massive Attack. I would also, I mean, that's difficult, you know. there's so many great records out there, aren't there?
Okay, instead of three, we'll do 30. Let's record for another hour. Let's go for 30 albums.
Yeah. Then let me keep going with the other two. I think, yeah, I mean, it depends how young, because I heard a lot of great music by the time I was 8 or 9, but I think, you know, I would definitely have played my 8-year-old self Paco de Lucía. So, you know, there's quite a few of his records I would have done. I can't really be specific about any one. And then, well, maybe actually Passion, Grace and Fire from John McLaughlin, Paco de Lucía and Aldi Meola, because it was very inspiring as a guitarist. And I guess in terms of one of my records, probably Beyond Skin, just because of what it was saying. I would have liked to have told my younger self that this will be an important moment in your life, making this record. So I guess it kind of, and there's something, because it was about me coming to terms with certain ideas, certain issues that I was having with my own identity, I think it would have helped me when I was younger to have heard it.
Let's thank Mr. Zawny for his time. Check him out on vinyl. Check him out in the theater. Check him out live. Check him out on your radio. He is there. He's everywhere. 30 plus years in the business. And we will catch you next time.